the rift. Except it doesn't seem to be playing. I will see what I can figure out.
It's relatively easy to recite facts about political ecological crises. The fact that plastics in our oceans are harming and killing over 700 species across the world, including humans. The fact that the fossil fuel industry is planning to increase plastic production by over 40% over the next decade. The fact that corporate polluters have steadfastly managed to evade regulation for decades. It's harder as any one person to decide what to do to try to make a dent in all of that, and just as hard to take stock of what you've learned along the way. Today, that one person is Dr. Maya Weeks, a California-based researcher and artist. Maya's research has addressed a range of topics, from ocean pollution and plastics, to indigenous land rights, to Marxist feminism. She's also a prolific artist who has produced poetry, photography, and music tied to these topics. After the break, you'll hear my conversation with Maya about her work, how she incorporates art into her research, and how she's engaged with the ecosystems, landscapes, and political movements that have shaped her life. As always, the views and opinions expressed during this show are mine and those of my guests, and don't necessarily represent the views of WEFT, its board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. But first, programming on WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you by That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet. 217-855-9673 and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop. And now, here's my conversation with Dr. Maya Weeks. Joining me now is Dr. Maya Weeks, a researcher, writer, poet, artist, all of the above. Thanks so much for joining me, Maya.
Thank you so much for having me, Roshan.
So just to start off, your research work is kind of this fascinating blend of marine science and ecology, but also a lot of the critical social sciences, feminist studies, indigenous studies. I understand that your background is, you know, growing up in a coastal town in California, and that to me certainly seems like it might lend itself to a lot of these topics. Could you talk a little bit about your background and how you came to this intersection of interests?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking about this. I always like to talk about how my research and creative and political interests came from where I grew up and how I grew up. So appreciate you asking. I grew up on Northern Chumash and Solanan land on the central coast of California in so-called San Luis Obispo County. And I grew up working class and did not have a lot of money for doing recreational activities, but the ocean was always free and easy to access. I lived within walking distance of it as a child. And so I spent a lot of time surfing, swimming, having potlucks and bonfires on the beach with friends and family. Birthday parties were always at the beach. Everybody always had a boogie board or a surfboard because you could get them at a yard sale for $10 and a secondhand wetsuit. And I think as a child, I was always balancing like my like love of reading and writing and art making, like drawing and painting and photography and all of that, with like my jock side of myself. And I felt like from a very early age that I had to choose one or the other, right? Like I had to decide if I was going to, you know, pursue, like my first big academic goal was studying abroad in Sweden, for which I fundraised extensively to spend a year outside of the country and like finish high school in 3 years to go spend my senior year in Sweden, right? Like to do that, and that meant sacrificing like surfing, right? But surfing absolutely shaped how I interact with the world, and often, especially like once I got to being confident in waves bigger than I was when I was around like 12 or 13, I was often the only woman in the water. And so usually by that time when I was surfing, it was often my stepdad, because it was before I could drive, my stepdad would take me down to the beach. I'd surf with him and his friends, and they'd be like, "Go, Maya," like call me into a wave, and I'd go and get it. And it was great, and I loved it, but I'd like look around and there would be like 15 other people out and I'd be the only woman. And I was always like, I didn't feel excluded the way I felt at the skate park. Like the skate park full of boys is a completely different scene, and it put me off skating. Like I stopped riding the half pipe when I was 13 because there were too many guys and it was like the vibes were off. But surfing was just like, just felt lonely being the only woman out there. And I grew up reading magazines like Wahine, which was a woman surf mag in the 90s, early 2000s, RAP. That really gave me a sense of like what women could do in the water, and like even like the historical legacies of women surfers, often Hawaiian women surfers, right? So it's not that I thought that surfing wasn't accessible to women, but again, it just felt really like kind of just like swimming against the current. And I got like just so concerned with the well-being of the ocean because of having my entire life organized around it forever, that we could fast forward to after I had finished an MFA, I was in my early 20s, and again, like this tension of like having to choose between my like now like more developed scholarly pursuits of like Marxist feminism and anti-colonial practices and environmental justice and like wanting to care for the ocean. And I spent so much time throughout my 20s feeling like I had to choose between writing about the environment and lacking like this historical materialist racial justice, social justice lens, and writing like serious scholarly work or serious poetry. And something clicked in me like around the time I was finishing my MFA. I got like the greatest gift I've ever received from myself, which was just not caring what anybody thought anymore. And I started writing this book of poetry about marine pollution, but I was able to bring everything that I had learned in being in like Marxist communist circles in the Bay Area, and everything that I had been, you know, reading about post-colonial theory and so on and so forth, into my ocean research, and that started to feel like, oh, I can actually do this. And being concerned with ecology isn't limited to like a liberal, quote, like capital E environmentalist perspective. And that's what propelled me to do a PhD in geography. Because somebody told me that you could get paid to do research. I had no idea you could get paid to do research. So that's why I went and did a PhD in geography, basically. I mean, long story short, there was a lot more to it. But all of those concerns absolutely came out of having a life that was organized around being outside, being in tune with the tides, being in tune with the wind. And that's like so deeply rooted in where I grew up, even though I grew up as a settler, which is kind of a confusing thing to talk about because I don't know like most of my ethnic background due to family history, but I'm gonna say like I grew up in settler culture.
Got it. And so I'm curious, you know, you were talking about finding your way outside of this like institutional environmentalist frame, right? Did you ever try it on to size, so to speak? Was there something that you found constraining about that?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I did. I tried to get involved with like Surfrider and Five Gyres, and I had really good experiences with individual people in those orgs, but I never felt like I knew how to like participate or show up correctly within the institutional framework. I also felt like nobody else quite shared my perspectives. Like the work that I was getting involved with in, especially like with Five Gyres, which I really respect, and I think it's amazing that they do policy work, and I think they're so important. But like they were focused on beach cleanups at the same time as like changing legislation, right? And I began developing my research on plastic pollution as a form of gendered violence and territorializing space and so on and so forth in a white masculinist framework, because I felt like I was the only person who was like, but beach cleanups aren't enough. And like, even though this organization is arguing for stopping pollution at the source, I want to know why the source is continuing to produce the waste. Like, I want to go even further upstream. So absolutely felt limited within the environmental discourse. And also just like I kept having, like I would write essays or pitch essays to places and keep having them rejected, or I'd have them rejected from like the Marxist magazines because they were too environmental, but then have like my essays rejected from the environmental orgs for being too radical. And that just went on for years and years. That still happens.
Oh, man. I would hope that the sort of like eco-Marxist world is a little bit more fleshed out these days, but who
I think
knows?
It's better now. I think it's a lot better now, and now there's just less money for publishing than there was 10 or 15 years ago.
Great, love it. But kind of coming back to your, you know, the research work that you were talking about, you know, you went off and did this PhD in geography, and as you mentioned, your dissertation engages the problem of marine debris and contamination, particularly from a feminist perspective. Could you just talk a little bit more about that and, you know, what you ended up finding?
Yeah, I ended up really, really working from like a very kind of, I guess, standard feminist standpoint theory perspective, Marxist feminist, materialist feminist perspective, that no position is neutral. There's no such thing as objectivity. Everybody inhabits a position. And really thinking about gender through that lens and through this lens of power rather than through the lens of the body, right? So instead of thinking so much about like, let's see, like additives in plastics such as BPA or PFAS substances or phthalates are disproportionately affecting people sexed female at birth, which is true and complex and I want to be like the most gender inclusive here when I speak about this, so I won't veer too far off in that direction right now. And that's true, but I wasn't really interested in that. I was interested more in like who is in the rooms that is making decisions about like what is our production goal for plastic packaging for lids this year, right? And then so it was like a very it was honestly like an absolutely impossible type of project where I was tracing all sorts of things and connecting them to each other and looking at like one of my case studies was on the Ocean Cleanup, which is a project by a Dutch man named Boyan Slat. And they are doing a series of cleanup efforts in the North Pacific Ocean, seeking to capture plastics and transport them back to land. But I was really concerned with kind of making it visible beyond the tiny sphere that of like marine ecologists and marine engineers who are pointing this out within their fields, that the entire premise of this initiative was flawed. And that while sure the Ocean Cleanup could collect plastic that it saw on the surface of the ocean and then bale it or however they transport it and ship it and turn it into sunglasses and make money off of it. I was interested in interpreting that case, for example, through a feminist lens of enclosure and territorialization and profit production. So very much I was trying to do something that, like, I don't know how successful I was ultimately, which was to apply a feminist political economic lens to this phenomenon at sea in real time. It was really hard. It was kind of a wild project. I think it does work as like a case study of enclosure and, you know, terms that will be familiar to many leftists, many people with political economic orientations, but I don't know how effective, obviously, it was in getting anybody to do anything differently, which just annoys me because, like, it's not that I think, oh, if you do research, it will change how people behave in the world or change how people do things in the world. But it was absolutely grueling to spend, you know, about 5 years of my life dedicated to like shining light on how absolutely exploitative and violent and like literally physically toxic these practices were, and what a giant, in my analysis, like misuse of resources, right? Like, why go to sea to collect waste to make yourself look good in a form of greenwashing when you could spend those efforts lobbying your government to not subsidize Coca-Cola instead, type of question, right? Like, I just felt so defeated after spending like several years looking at this problem and then only learning how much bigger it was, and only learning how much bigger it was, and only learning how much more widespread it was than, like, I wasn't naive about plastics and their harms when I started this project. And I came out of the project thinking, I have to start doing something substantive that feels like building good in the world, because if I keep looking at the problem, I'm going to feel like I'm inside of a hole that I can't see my way out of. Which got me really interested in raising sheep for biodegradable fiber. And obviously critical indigenous studies, which is, as many like you and your listeners probably know, like very, very focused on ways to actually live through a historical moment and make things decent going forward, right? Instead of just problematizing.
Wait, but say more about the sheep. I didn't know about this.
Oh, that's my gosh.
What I'm talking about the sheep.
Okay, so probably by like, I've always really loved sheep. But by the time I was a few years into my PhD, I started going, okay, well, it looks like imposing regulations on the companies that produce the most plastics is not really a viable political move, right? Like, I want to keep organizing for that. I have friends and colleagues and peers and fellow researchers who are organizing for that. But that's like, you know, we see the plastics treaty negotiations that have been happening over the last few years, and they're not going anywhere. Like, the U.S. literally just announced, I think last week, that it was at odds with the target goals of the plastics treaty, right? Like, that's slow moving, if anything. And so I started thinking, what can I do that's faster? And it, even if it's individualistic, even if it's I just raise 6 sheep, which is like, this is my goal now, is that in 2026, I'm gonna get my first flock and it's gonna be 6 sheep. If I do that, then I'm physically tending to something in the world that's producing a biodegradable fiber. Does it reduce the amount of plastic that's already in the world? Absolutely not. Am I still going to pick up plastic when I see it on the beach? Yes, because I don't want to hurt the sea squirts or the urchins or the otters. So all that to say, I got really interested in raising sheep because I wanted to do something physical that embodied my values, right? Like, instead of just being like, here's the problem, and harping on the problem over and over again and trying to work very, very slowly for some sort of regulations and reducing plastic pollution, I wanted to also physically be building something good. And that set me, that combined with 2 fires really close to where I was living in 2020. I was living on acreage, and we had 2 fires, like each less than 2 miles away. And it became very obvious to me that the land could really benefit from more stewardship, including obviously good fire, but also reducing fire fuel loads through the use of ruminants on the land. Set me off on this shepherding journey. So I decided that I wanted to participate in the wool supply chain, as well as being able to provide good meat. And so I've been learning how to raise sheep for the last few years, and my goal is to get my first flock next year, starting just with 6.
Very cool. And I feel like this does also kind of touch on some of your more recent work on indigenous land management in California. You've been doing some writing and advocacy around public land allotments. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been working at a really small nonprofit called the California Public Domain Allottee Association, or CAPDA for short, for a little over the last year. And I'm obviously speaking just on my own behalf, not on CAPTA's behalf here. But what CAPTA does is advocate for the rights of California Indians who have had their lands stolen by the United States and then, quote, allotted back to them through this public domain allotments process. But many people have lost access to their lands in processes of fractionation as people have passed away, and the land who holds title to the land has gotten spread among more and more people. And part of why this work is so important is because almost all of the public domain allottees are from federally unrecognized tribes. Not everyone, but many, many people. So it's the most disenfranchised of the most disenfranchised mm-hmm. in California, right? And in a lot of cases, people were pushed off of their homelands to elsewhere and then allotted land there. So in some cases, people are on their traditional homelands. In others, it's like, well, maybe they have an allotment, or they're on the, like their name is on the, I think it's the title. It's really tricky because the way it's set up, the US federal government still owns the land, and it's held in trust for the people who are, think it's called title holders, but I might be wrong here. So in any case, a lot of times people like maybe have an allotment, but it's only an allotment in this one location, and maybe that's where their tribe only was during a specific part of the year, right? So there are still so many limitations in place for people to be able to practice their culture. And another reason why we're doing this advocacy work is because usually it's the BIA, although for some allotments it's the Forest Service. There are a couple different types of allotments, but we work on public domain allotments. Those are generally owned by the BIA. People have to seek permission from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in order to do anything on their own lands that they are allottees of, which is just tremendously limiting, not even to mention, like, I personally think that's morally wrong, right? Ethically wrong. But aside from that layer, say, you know, Sam wants to have a cultural burn on their allotment. Sam is supposed to seek permission from the BIA to carry out the cultural burn. But the BIA is so, whether you want to say backlogged or there's just like a bureaucratic delay, right? So it will usually take maybe 5 to 10 years to get a burn permit.
Oh my gosh.
And so one of our long-term goals, or one of CAPTA's long-term goals, right, is to like reduce the bureaucratic limitations and give people more stewardship, active stewardship of their own lands. And so that goes for everything, not just a cultural fire. If somebody wants to build a home or a gathering space on their allotments, there are just so many limitations that, again, in my opinion, should not be in place for these people. And I definitely became interested in land back work while researching plastic pollution as, I got into researching plastic pollution, right, because it's such a clear example of colonial fossil violence. But of course, colonial fossil fuel driven violence takes all sorts of shapes. And the more I researched plastic pollution, the more I ended up reading about land back efforts and also just witnessing them in real time. Like Standing Rock, for instance, mm-hmm. is the first big one that I was able to follow in real time. And I did, the other thing that I wanted to touch on is that I learned of this position through colleagues at UC Davis, which is where I had done my PhD. So it was very much like in like a network that I was already somewhat active in.
Got it. And, you know, as disparate as all these threads of your work are, there's definitely a common thread that I'm feeling in the sense that you're constantly tackling these issues of enclosure and colonial violence and the ways that this manifests through, you know, the capitalist world system. And so one of the things that I find fascinating about your work is that you've incorporated artistic practices into your research to a pretty significant degree. You know, you mentioned writing a poetry book. You've done music, you've done photography. Could you talk a little bit about what drew you to these forms of expression? And I know you mentioned before kind of not wanting to have to choose. Is that kind of what brought that sort of thing into your work?
Definitely. Thanks so much for asking about this. I've been trying to think about a concise way to answer this question since you sent me your question drafts the other day. And I was like realizing that, you know, when you're a child and everyone's like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was always like, I want to be an artist. Like and that like kind of open to the world feeling that like being an artist entails for me, and like wanting to like communicate, like to me that's like what being an artist is about like communicating, probably like pretty broadly, right? And like that feeling meeting with like the realities of making a living in the world and like participating in society, I think that's why I have continued to like maintain an art practice through my whole adulthood. I actually think that I would not be okay without it. So like the first answer to your question is just like making art is something that's imperative to my existence. I think that's something common for a lot of people, that we have to be doing something creative, whether that's like working on cars or like coming up with a rotational grazing plan or cooking And for me, like, I wish it was cooking, but, like, I think cooking's really boring. I don't know why I would rather write 16 poems than cook dinner. It's silly, but here we are. But all this to say, I was an artist before I was a researcher, and I trained as a researcher in order to become a better artist. Sometimes to the point where I feel like I'm not a very skilled researcher because I focus too much on my art and not enough on, say, qualitative methods. or like, since I finished my PhD, I still have yet to publish a piece of research, like strict research, in a journal, in a peer-reviewed journal. Like, have I published poetry in peer-reviewed journals? Yes. Does that count as publishing research? I don't think so. But I am happy that, like, if I'm going to talk about the field of geography, which is what I'm trained in, like, I have gotten to push the field to being more containing other ways of knowing besides, like, traditional qualitative or quantitative or even mixed methods research. And the other thing that I think about a lot is people are so curious and people want to have opportunities to like think creatively and be useful. So I've like done a lot of talks and like guest lectures, and like I was honored to be able to give a keynote talk at Bodega Marine Lab at UC Davis last year, and I've mentored students, and I find so many people want to incorporate artistic practice into their research, and not just humanities researchers or social scientists. Actually, like, most of the people I've spoken with have been like hardcore physical scientists, like biogeochemists, who are like, well, I'm a biogeochemist, but I also do installation art, you know, like, absolutely, yes, let's go. Like, my long-term dream is to be facilitating like site-specific outdoor creative practices for people that are grounded in some sort of data collection or another, like using the term data collection really loosely because I see like a really big need for that in the various corners of society that I participate in.
That's awesome. I'm particularly interested in some of the music that you've worked on. You released a short album called Tethers in 2021. It's sort of an amalgamation of poetry, field recordings, some synthesizer work. I guess not just for your music, but for all of your artistic work that's related to some of this like disciplinary research. What's your process like for taking your thoughts on the things that you study and turning them into music or turning them into poetry, and taking you know what you see in the environment, what you see in the political realm, and transmuting that into art?
Yeah, this is where I'm really, really happy that I have like the project management experience that I gained through like the high levels of autonomy that one has in a graduate program. I think there are a lot of ways to learn project, like how to manage a project, but I figured out like what works for me, and I know that everybody is different, but I have found that I really like to start with a goal and to have that goal be flexible. So I will have a goal, I'll build a framework, but I don't really have a plan for the outcome, and I think that that's really important, and I think that that is really relationship based for me. Like, the outcome of the project is always whatever it evolves into being, and that's based off of like the relationship with the land that I'm physically recording, or the relationship I have with my collaborator, or what I end up feeling like I need to do to make the project happen. And so like that's absolutely a through line through like all of the manuscripts I've written, all of the poetry I've published, the music I've made, performances I've done, where like I like, sure, it's my project, and in that way like I'm in charge, but also I am responding to the situation at hand. And I think like having both a strong framework where I'm like, okay, like I know that I'm working with like I can talk about tethers, for instance, right? Like I knew that I wanted to be speaking to the context that pollutants are moving through, but I didn't want to hit my listener over the head with like bunch of facts about pollutants, because like it was 2021. We all knew that pollutants were bad, and we all know that they're caused by like fossil fuel companies, right? So instead I like tilted the lens a little bit to move sideways and to think about like the actual physical animals, the seaweeds, the waters that are like being affected by the way the climate is changing as a result of the burning of the fossil fuels and the release of microplastics and nanoplastics into the ecosystems and changing the water temperature and the water acidity and so on and so forth. And so that's why, like, for me, it's interesting to name like some fact about a specific plankton and maybe like an amount of foam that indicates dead plankton instead of being more explicit about it. It's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, I've received a lot of feedback on my academic writing that I need to be more explicit, that I need to signpost more, that I need to tell my readers more what I am delivering to them. And it's made me really lean into being an artist, because like I want whoever is engaging with the work to feel free to like interpret it in their own mind, because they know things that I don't know, right? And like that's like why we're in a world together. And I guess I just wanted to also like speak a little bit to collaboration. I really trust working alone. I really trust my vision. I think that that's like one of the greatest things that we can do as creative people, is to like believe in ourselves and our visions. And also I have really had positive experiences of collaboration, and in poetry or writing or even performance, like I don't have to collaborate, but like in music I did, and I collaborated with my co-producer, my friend Andrew Weathers, who co-produced and mixed and mastered Tethers with me and for me, who I've known since we were at Mills at the same time. And being able to like communicate my vision for the record and then work with somebody on it to execute that together was like a transformative political moment in my life, right? In the same way that like showing up at Occupy was in 2011 and feeling like we are doing this together, we are in this together. There is something happening that we can do by combining our forces, for lack of better words, that I couldn't do alone. And so I, not to be all like, art can save the world, because like obviously there are limitations to what art can do, but like despite being much, much, much more cynical now in my mid-30s than I was when I was younger, I really do think that like using our imaginations is important.
Well, I'm glad you brought this back around to the political, because I think that's what I want to close with is, and this is something that you've touched on before, is that we're navigating a brutal political landscape, and you know, even before the most recent federal election in the United States, you know, you were talking about how hard it is to even impose the most basic environmental regulations. That's something that I'm very familiar with in sort of my world. And when you think about all these different aspects of ecological and eco-social politics that you've explored through your work, is there anything that feels particularly important to you in relation to making change and building a better world together?
Yeah, I think like the first thing that comes to mind is like maintaining a sense of curiosity. And I don't mean that in like a bland, optimistic type of way, but like I don't think that before Zoran Mamdani's campaign, I had imagined that like a young person would bother to run in a Democratic mayoral race, right? And would bother to like have that type of political imagination, because most leftists I know are like, screw Democrats, they only do things wrong, which like, I don't need to go off on a tangent here, but I think that his campaign is a really interesting example of political imagination and seeing the structural limits that we are up against in a really, really violent landscape, and going, you know, I think I'm gonna mess with that. I think I'm gonna interrupt it. And So I think one thing is like being imaginative about what we can interrupt and renegotiate. And I don't say this naively, like I tried working in policy for a year thinking I could change any tiny itty bitty bit of any system from an inside, and it was soul destroying. So I don't say that lightly, but at the same time, I want to be honest about how I think like there are possibilities for shifting things. Another is unions. As soon as I can join a union, I'm going to. I miss that part of being a graduate student. I think unions have a lot of power. I don't think they're perfect, but I absolutely, like, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's a pretty big parallel between the decline of taxing millionaires and billionaires and the decline of unions in the United States.
Oh, yeah. It's measurable. It's demonstrable. Like, you're not wrong. That's just objectively correct.
Okay, and I guess like the third thing that I think about in politics is remembering why. Like, why am I doing this? And like, what am I looking for? What is my goal? Like for me, that's been pretty easy to have in mind when I've had like the ocean as like my why. Like, I want the ocean to be alive and in a good state in 100 years, in 500 years, in 6,000 years. But there are a bunch of different whys that, of course, anybody operates within. And I think that so much of leftist politics that like I've witnessed or participated in for the last like 15, 20 years has been reacting to a very organized right, and I want us on the left to set our own goals more and to work toward them. And that might, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, like that might mean that that we have to actually aim to amass some power, right? Which like I know is often interpreted as an authoritarian impulse. I don't think it has to go that way. And I understand why a lot of leftists are averse to vying for power, because we are focused on liberation. Like that is often the goal for many of us. But I don't see, like never in my life have I participated in anything that has gotten done without having a clear goal.
Well, I think that's as solid a place as any to wrap things up. Have goals. Set goals.
Have goals. Set goals. Have friends. Set goals. Do things together. Go outside. Touch grass. Remember why you're here.
Great suggestions. Great suggestions, all of them. But Maya, thank you so much for taking the time to speak. I kind of feel like we've barely even scratched the surface of all the stuff that we could talk about. But, you know, thank you so much. If people want to follow your work, is there a place that they can do that?
Sure. I have a website. It is mayaweeks.com. Weeks like weeks in a month. Maya like the civilization. I am on Instagram and Twitter and Blue Sky at Seaweed Report.
Seaweed Report. Love it. Dr. Maya Weeks, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Dr. Maya Weeks, researcher, writer, activist, and artist. I want to thank Maya once again for coming on the show and sharing her expertise and her story with us. I think that there was a lot in what Maya spoke about that will feel very relatable to left-wing activists, particularly those focusing on climate and ecological issues, the personal connections to land or water, the conflict between seeking long-term policy change and taking immediate action on a smaller scale, and figuring out how to move as an individual while trying to contribute to collective well-being. I think one thing that really resonated with me personally is the importance of maintaining an artistic practice, as Maya said, not because we need to pretend that it has some kind of enormous political power or significance that it really doesn't, but because it can be one part of the vast constellation of efforts to build people's movements And we've seen that over the years, from the labor movements to civil rights to indigenous liberation movements. Speaking for myself, that can be an easy thing to forget in darker political times such as these. And engaging with Maya's poetry and her music, which I should note, you also can do at mayaweeks.com, was a welcome corrective. But as for today, that's all I've got for you. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM Community Radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, we've got some tunes for a little bit, and then at the top of the hour is On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, August 3rd. Until then, take care.
Programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Plant Mode in downtown Champaign. Since 2013, Plant Mode has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical and succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records, and local-made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, and rolling pins. Plant Mode now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram and on plantmode.com.
Did the National Weather Service cuts worsen the disaster in Texas? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The flooding in Texas during the July 4th storm killed at least 129 people, including 36 children. And as of July 13th, there were still about 160 missing.
The Guadalupe River rose around 26 feet in 45 minutes after rain fell at a rate of up to 4 inches an hour in some places, and along a basin that's nicknamed Flash Flood Alley because of its terrain.
Questions have been raised regarding cuts made by the Trump administration to the National Weather Service, which may have prevented forecasters from warning of possible flooding.
Alan Girard, a recent retiree of NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory, wrote on Substack that the National Weather Service did a solid job, and there's little evidence that any of the recent cuts negatively impacted the agency's services for the event.
However, the Trump administration has proposed cuts that would close that laboratory, which develops tools to predict flash flooding.
The disaster has also raised questions about why Kerr County, where the flooding occurred, didn't have adequate warning systems, including sirens. The New York Times reports that last October, FEMA warned about potentially dangerous flooding in the area with a loss of life and damage to property.
However, local officials were rebuffed by the state in their attempts to secure the $1 million it would take
Let
to
me guess.
Build
You're
the system.
Thinking about
Earth's glaciers and ice caps are melting rapidly because of climate change, which will cause sea levels to rise, influence weather patterns, and affect freshwater access around the globe. Another consequence of losing all that ice, according to a new study, more explosive volcanic eruptions.
Researchers led by the University of Wisconsin-Madison say that hundreds of dormant volcanoes worldwide, particularly in Antarctica, could become active as global warming accelerates melting.
Thick layers of ice can keep a lid on eruptions by pressing Earth's crust that sits atop chambers of magma. Once a glacier retreats, the gases in the magma can expand and the volcanoes explode.
The link between glacial loss and volcanic activity has been known since the 1970s, when eruptions in Iceland were linked to retreating ice. But the team says it could happen elsewhere, like parts of North America, New Zealand, Antarctica, and Russia, so they warrant closer attention.
Lead author Pablo Moreno-Jaeger says that eruptions can cool the planet temporarily, but multiple ones can accelerate global warming by pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That creates a feedback loop where melting glaciers trigger eruptions, which in turn can further warming and melting.
Ukraine is undergoing a rapid transformation to renewable energy in response to constant attacks by Russia on its energy infrastructure.
Last week, the European Union announced $700 million in financing for Ukraine's energy systems and transport networks. The funds will help implement projects including solar, biomass, geothermal heat pumps, and battery storage.
Ukraine's energy infrastructure has suffered almost $21 billion in damage from the war, according to the UN, including the destruction of more than half of its power generation capacity.
The single largest loan from the EU of $140 million will repair three plants of the country's biggest hydropower company. In a separate project, water is being pumped using solar power to ensure supplies are available 24/7.
Fast Company reports Ukraine is already adding solar panels to school and hospital rooftops and placing batteries in their basements. Similar projects are being developed at multifamily housing units. Additionally, renewable technology education centers are launching, even in coal mining areas, for training on wind turbines, solar panels, and heat pumps.
Speaking of renewable energy, solar power is growing worldwide, but still faces challenges in part because it's affected by weather, atmospheric conditions, and the changing angle of the sun during the year, which can make it difficult for grid operators to balance supply and demand.
For more accurate forecasts, utilities rely on historical data to predict future performance, and recently this has meant using artificial intelligence.
However, AI can only be as good as the data it's fed, which can be scarce in rural areas. So researchers at Charles Darwin University in Australia investigated whether adding indigenous knowledge to the mix would enhance accuracy, given First Nations peoples have been observing natural cycles for thousands of years.
The team integrated information from the seasonal calendars of 4 First Nations communities in northern Australia and found that the forecasts improved by nearly 15% and had an over 25% reduction in errors compared to a baseline model.
Unlike our modern calendars with 4 seasons, ancient ones developed by First Nations can range between 3 to 7 seasons based on ecological cues such as plant and animal behaviors, which are closely tied to changes in sunlight and weather patterns.
The team's new data set is the first to incorporate First Nations knowledge and could be a valuable tool for advancing solar in rural areas, especially in the places where indigenous people live.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Last June, 13 inches of rain fell on parts of South Dakota in just 3 days, flooding miles of cropland and causing rivers to overflow. Just 2 months later, about 1 foot of rain hit Connecticut in 1 day, covering roads with mud and water and killing 2 people. And this year, several days of heavy downpours caused the Ohio and Kentucky rivers to flood, devastating many homes and businesses in Indiana and Kentucky. As the climate changes, this kind of extreme rain is expected to become more common in many areas. Climate change is causing Earth's atmosphere to get warmer, and warmer air can absorb a lot more water. All that water builds up into clouds until it releases as a major storm, sometimes dumping inches of rain in mere hours. When that much rain falls all at once, it can quickly fill up stormwater drains. Water can then rush into low-lying areas and even cause flash floods. Because of climate change, people from the Northeast to the Midwest to the South now face a higher risk of intense rain and dangerous floods, so it's important that everyone make a plan to keep themselves and their homes safe in case extreme weather hits. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
To the radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio
on. Turn your radio on.
If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of the endless spring.
Hi, this is Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and you're listening to 90.1 FM Champaign, WEFT.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Champaign Park District. Enjoy live jazz music? Champaign Park District's Jazz in the Park concert series is happening all summer long at a variety of park locations. Everyone is invited to bring lawn chairs, snacks, and refreshments. The full Jazz in the Park schedule can be found at champaignparks.org.
And again, we thank all of our listeners, donors, contributors, community partners that helped keep WEFT viable and on the air.
If you have a passion for bluegrass, local music, or reggae, then you are in luck because you are tuned to 90.1 FM WEFT. Our programming is created by our volunteer staff. At WEFT, it is elected committee members, enthusiastic air shifters, and dedicated members who decide what is unique and important to hear on the radio. WEFT is home to a wealth of knowledgeable hosts who bring you fascinating programs each week. Whether you're into gospel or jazz, Celtic jigs or Delta blues, salsa or hip-hop, we've got a show for you. If you have a passion for unique music and information, show it and help us continue to provide this service to you. Please go to weft.org and click on the Support WEFT link.